everybody for coming along to this discussion. I hope that despite the title of the talk, we can have a very uplifting conversation about what we can do to fight the alienation and the misery of capitalism. But to do so, I think we do have to start with confronting how much capitalism really does make us miserable and does create so much mental distress in our lives. There is a mental health crisis, and it's openly discussed in Australian capitalism by our ruling class constantly. No longer do we have the kind of open or the repressive stigma around mental illness. There is slightly less mystification around the kind of distress and the rates of distress that people experience. The Australian Bureau of Statistics says that there's about 45% of Australians who will experience mental ill health, anxiety, depression, addiction, and other forms of mental distress throughout their lives. And the ruling class has moved, I think, since we had an interesting discussion, maybe even a debate, maybe 5 years ago at Keep Left about mental illness. And we were talking much more at that point, I think, about biological determinism and the way that the ruling class sort of pathologizes mental ill health and sees it as a chemical imbalance entirely. And there was a really very rigid, reductive approach to mental illness. And I think that is still overwhelmingly the case in the way that mental distress is understood and talked about under capitalism and in Australia. But there have been some shifts, I think, in since we had that talk, in understanding that the way our society is organised and the way that people experience their lives and experience adverse events in their lives has an impact on how you feel and why you might be feeling badly. And so much so that the government is investing more and more money. Every year it invests more and more money, not to good effect, but it does invest more and more money into trying to solve to solve the problem of mental illness. But I think it has to be said, and it has always been the case under capitalism, that the ruling class is dreadful, very, very dreadful at dealing with misery. It compounds it. It makes it worse, manifold, deepening people's mental crises, diminishing people's agency, insulting them, and in various ways. Throughout the history of capitalism, the approach to people experiencing mental distress has been asylum, exclusion, stigma, horrific and actually catastrophic sort of electric shock, tranquilization, isolation, and even, throughout Nazi Germany, psychiatry has a very terrible terrible history of mass killings. But more recently, I think the individual pathologizing, which we see still happens, in terms of diagnosing people individually as experiencing mental illness. But there has been, I think many of us probably would have seen this in our own work or perhaps experienced, been on the receiving end of trauma theory. So a slightly more psychosocial approach to understanding why people are distressed, sees that or recognises that, it's not all in your head necessarily. It's not all about chemical imbalances or, a lack of serotonin or anything like that. But that actually, bad things happen to people and there are consequences for them and it makes people feel dreadful. So this approach and the trauma-informed theory has kind of, I don't know about lots of other people's workplaces, but definitely in education, it is now so central to so much of what we do. We have trauma-informed practice, we have trauma-informed PD, we are constantly talking about how we have to understand the way that trauma impacts individuals, but the way that is communicated to us is that it stunts the brain and we're kind of reducing human beings. Once again, once we understand what the different adverse impacts on people have been, it's always kind of framed as ultimately an image on a slide, on a PowerPoint slide of, you know, a brain that's atrophied or, you know, caught, you know, at a four-year-old level, or a brain stem that's not kind of properly functioning and shooting out the right messages across the brain. It does have a reductive biological ultimately comprehension, and the insulting sort of solutions that we are encouraged to offer people who we are supposed to understand as being trauma affected are things like fidget spinners in class, or, you know, brain breaks where, you know, kids are supposed to be allowed to do thumb wars with each other to get their bodies moving in line with their brains. You know, if you were experiencing trauma, if you did have trauma, those of us who have experienced trauma, the idea that this can be dealt with thumb wars, or that you can be fully, you know, emboldened at school, or, you know, feel confident, empowered with your work by having like mental brain breaks and being able to scroll through your phone every now and then, it is totally insulting, and it really misses the mark of what is going on with mental distress. And I think the other problem with trauma-informed approaches or trauma-informed theory and other theories like it is that it characterises the problems that we experience as adverse externalities to capitalism, things that happen, you know, despite capitalism or sort of alongside it. They're problematic things that are the outcome, not of the essential functioning of capitalism itself, but kind of random unfortunate events that people might experience, like car crashes or having bad parents, you know, incidentally. Things like this. So it's a attempt at a more psychosocial kind of integration of the brain, the body, and society. But ultimately, in the ruling class's hands, it becomes reductive and insulting and patronising and useless at doing anything about the mental health crisis that people do experience. So what can Marxism offer? I think that I want to talk mainly today about this theory of alienation and how Marx's theory of alienation really does empower us with a way of understanding the deep misery that we feel, not just as kind of consequences of the more outrageous and horrifying aspects of living under capitalism, like watching a genocide unfold, but also the day-to-day life experience. Some people, you know, call it first world problems, to be feeling totally miserable, you know, when you've got the daily grind in front of you. You can't pinpoint what exactly has gone wrong in your life, but you know that something is really wrong and you're not free, you're not feeling good, you know, and that idea of well-being, you know, it feels mystifying, it feels beyond you. And I think Marxism really, the theory of alienation gives us really, really useful insights into why that's happening and what we can do about it. So what is alienation according to Marx? So in the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts, which are some of Marx's early writings, he outlined this very powerful theory that starts with, or it doesn't start with it, but it relies on a discussion about workers' lack of control over the labour process, where all our human activity is experienced as something that's external, alien, and hostile to us. This stems from the capitalist mode of production. It's not an idea or a culture or a greed or a mean-spiritedness or, you know, anything kind of idealistic, but it's fundamentally the way our society is currently organised for production alienates us. Before getting into the different elements of alienation, the question of human nature for Marxists, there is no eternal and unchanging human nature, or no checklist of entitlements or capacities or standard of well-being that, you know, Marx sort of was like, if we achieve this, you know, there will be well-being, you know, people will feel good. He didn't see human beings like that, and he didn't see human nature like that. So historical materialism and the Marxist method says that we have material needs, but these are always socially contingent, and how we fulfill them is always specific to how a society is organized. And that's because an essential part of our humanness, a really, really fundamental, well, the thing that separates us from animals is our conscious, creative and transformative labour. It's our propensity to labour, to fulfil our material needs that makes us human. thank you. So to obtain what we need to survive, we need to think. You know, other animals act instinctively in order to obtain what they need, but for human beings, because, you know, we live across such a variety of circumstances, environmental, social circumstances, we need to be creative, we need to work together, communicate together, and creatively, consciously come up with solutions and ideas about how we are going to fulfill our needs. We can't rely on inbuilt instinct to do that. So that conscious labour, the conscious, the activity to produce is essential to who we are as human beings. But under capitalism, we're alienated from it. So firstly, we're alienated from the products of our labour. Because when we go to work, it doesn't matter if we don't actually produce physical objects, but whatever we produce is objectified, it's objectified labour. There's a product that the boss takes and owns, and we are immediately alienated from it. So Marx says the object that labour produces, labour's product, confronts it as something alien, as a power independent of the producer. The producer of labour is labour which has been embodied in an object which has become material. It is the objectification of labour. Under the economic conditions, this realisation of labour appears as a loss of realisation for workers. Objectification as a loss of object and bondage to it, appropriation as estrangement, as alienation. So, you know, whether you are somebody who's making a pair of jeans or, you know, like me, sometimes it feels like I'm a maker of study scores, for example, you know, it's not my study score, even if that's really what I invested all my, you know, energy in, and it is what I invest all my energy in a day-to-day sense. The boss takes the study score. They advertise it on the website. They say that's their study score that they've achieved. And so I am alienated from what I've done. And not only am I alienated from it, it's used against me. The boss's power grows. With every product that I produce, it turns into a product that the boss uses against me for my own domination. They have accrued it, and it's no longer mine. It's no longer my power. True as I say across whether you're making something concrete or whether you're offering a service or whatever it is that you're working. If you're working, your product is not yours anymore. The second form of alienation, it's not just the product, Marx says, it goes deeper than that. It's labour itself. We work for our bosses, not for ourselves. So the labour that we do is forced, it's estranged, it's not willing anymore, which is totally against the nature of labour itself. So he says, in his work, therefore, he does not affirm himself, but denies himself, does not feel contented, but unhappy, does not develop freely his physical and mental energy, but mortifies his body and ruins his mind. Our activity, our day-to-day activity, what you do when you show up at work, and the conscious, you know, your own mind employed in the nature of work, that creative energy that I was talking about previously is harnessed, that activity for life is harnessed by the boss. So your day-to-day being, you are estranged from. So that's the idea that you're essentially, you are estranged from your own self, your own activity, your own life force. And this idea as well that things that are in our interests, you know, like I said before, it's not in my interests to produce study scores at all. I hate study scores, but I don't have a control over that, you know, unless I'm in struggle with the boss, and I'll come to that. But that's not within my power. I don't have control over what it is I produce. So whether you're producing, you know, weapons or, you know, stacking ships or plugging things into computers all day, whatever it is, you are doing it not in and for yourself, but, you know, your labour is again, it's for the ruling class. There are a few other forms of estrangement and alienation that Marx talks about, and he has a long discussion about nature, which maybe we can talk about in the discussion. But you know, the one that I wanted to move on from to is the estrangement of man from man. So this kind of conception that we are alienated from each other, and in it is necessary for human beings in order to achieve a single thing, you know, in our lives. In order to survive, we have to work together. But under capitalism, we are forced against each other. We're forced in competition with each other. And this idea that we are competing against each other and separated from each other as units in the marketplace is really important. But I think it's deeper than that. When Marx talks about when we meet each other, we meet each other as people who have been estranged from our products, from our labour power. I've lost the quote. Sorry, I can't find it. But it's basic. It's kind of the idea is that an alienated self meets another alienated self. Now you think about social anxiety. When I was reading this, I was just thinking, you know, how could we not be socially anxious all the time when, you know, we are divorced from ourselves and then meet another person who's divorced from their self, who's not acting in their own interests. To kind of overcome that and connect with each other is such a challenge, because we are, in that way, totally divorced from each other. So we are not in control. And it's not just the workplace. So these are the relations of production, but they're manifested in the work that isn't immediately productive, you know, in schools, in the way that politics works, in exercise regimes, you know, in everything that we do. These same sort of patterns repeat each other because the foundations of how our society is organised are so. So what's the way out? Marx didn't have a conception that, you know, you just wait until socialism and then you'll feel better. It really wasn't. That was never kind of, and I think for us it never is anything that we want to tell anybody who's experiencing mental distress, just wait for socialism. Here's the quote that I did find. The continual conflicts between masters and men are the indispensable means of holding up the spirit of the labouring classes, of combining them into one great association against the encroachment of the ruling class and preventing them from becoming apathetic, thoughtless or more or less well-fed instruments of production. So in struggle, we begin to create new forms and models of existence, and we can unleash some of that alienated labour, that alienated existence, in very, very creative ways. And I think so many of us have experienced that lately in the struggle for Palestine. And I know certainly this has been like a life lesson in confronting alienation in teachers and school staff of Palestine, where people who, you know, colleagues who you're alienated from in a daily sense in workplaces, coming together and requiring constant socialization, like requiring constant communication in very literal ways, recreating or inverting the way that we are creating products. So, you know, in Teachers for Palestine, for example, we created a teaching guide because we were like, we don't want to teach crap. We want to teach what happened in Palestine and what Australia's relationship to Palestine is. So, you know, we created a whole teaching guide that has different curriculum to what, you know, our ruling class wants to create. But this in itself posed new needs. Like, we've got this curriculum that we've all created together. How do we teach it? How are we going to be allowed to teach it? So we had to come up with a new way and consider how do we work together to confront, you know, the ruling class and ensure that we can teach this stuff, that our daily activity is allowed to be expressed in this way. And so that required new, you know, forms of labour, you know, to challenge the bosses, getting out, you know, lots of endorsements from the Greens and, you know, all the different trade unions groups and, you know, holding rallies and speak outs and teach-ins and so on to get people to feel confident. And that was a huge amount of labour, and in it, the product couldn't be taken from us by the ruling class. It's an anathema to them. They don't want to touch that. They don't want to touch our teaching guide, and they certainly don't want to touch the work that we did, you know, to say that we're allowed to teach it. That's ours. That's our labour, you know, that we are using to confront their power. It's not the end of the story, obviously, and it's not, you know, it's not even halfway there in terms of what it will require to feel fully emancipated and to feel free and in open communication and freely able to labour in a you know, delightful and creative way. But, you know, you can feel the inklings of it in struggle. I do just want to say, I think the opposite can be true as well. Sometimes politics can feel like it mirrors work. You know, you can have a to-do list of 50,000 things and it can feel like a very socially anxious thing to come, you know, to a meeting and stick your hand up and say something, and then all the insecurities come out and all the rest of it. All of those things are, I'll wrap up, definitely true. Of how anything can feel under capitalism, because those social forces and those the way that our social relations are designed kind of creates that dynamic constantly and makes us feel like commodities and objects all the time. But I think that that lesson about intervention, about wrestling control over our labour and owning it ourselves and feeling that collective power as a way to confront that feeling and confront that misery that capitalism creates all the time is so essential. And I think that's something that we have to hold on to when we're talking about mental health crises of all different kinds, that, whatever the solutions are being posed by the ruling class at the moment, whether they're biological or cognitive behavioural therapy or fidget spinners in classrooms or, whatever reductive thing it is at the time, class struggle is key. Class struggle has to be part of the solution that we're always kind of... the main aim is, and it may be that we take a fidget spinner into the meeting or whatever it is to get us through the meeting, but unless we're fighting, that spirit and that sense of where is our human potential and do I even have human potential is going to be eclipsed. So that's why we've got to keep fighting.